This is Fresh Air. For years, organized crime flourished in major cities across the country, held together by a code of silence and a fierce brand of loyalty. More recently, in cities like Philadelphia and New York, crime dynasties are crumbling, brought down by forces inside and outside the organizations. Law enforcement has imposed stiffer sentences for mobsters found guilty of criminal activity. And more mobsters are entering the Witness Protection Program, trading jail time for incriminating evidence. George Anastasia covers white-collar and organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer and is currently covering the trial of Philadelphia criminal defense attorney Robert Simone. Simone has been the longtime attorney for Philadelphia mob boss Nicodemus Scarfo, who's now in jail. The federal indictment against Simone included charges of being privy to discussions about two mob murders, acting as a go-between for loan sharking operations, and being part of a scheme back in the mid-80s to extort money from a Philadelphia developer named Willard Rouse. I asked Anastasia about Simone's reputation in Philadelphia.
Simone's reputation is as a defense attorney who is almost a genius on his feet. He's very good in court. And he's represented organized crime figures for must be close to 15 or 20 years. But he has an extensive criminal practice other than mob guys. But he's gotten most of his notoriety from representing Nicky Scarfo.
And Simone is acting as his own attorney. And
right.
And I'm wondering, someone in the court observing, how good is he doing that? And what advantage is it for him to be his own attorney?
It cuts two ways. There's been a couple occasions where I think he's gotten too emotional as he's cross-examining the witnesses. But the advantage of it is Simone made the opening statement in that he spoke directly to the jury, and he'll probably make the closing statement, which again gives him a chance to speak directly to the jury. He can do that without taking the witness stand and having to be cross-examined. That's the advantage of representing himself, and he's done it effectively in the other two trials in which he was acquitted. And I think this case is going to come down to how effective his closing is and how effective the government's closing is to try to tie up all the loose ends and answer the questions that linger out there about the credibility of the witnesses.
So he can be his own spin doctor.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what he's doing. And in the past, he's been very effective with that.
Well, there have been a number of witnesses who have taken the stand, and these are witnesses who have been members of organized crime and now have turned to represent the state. One of them is Phil Leonetti.
Right.
And he was an underboss of the Scarfo crime family
right.
in Philadelphia. He was known as Crazy Phil.
Yes.
Do you think informants do make credible witnesses?
Yeah, to a degree. I mean, there's never any question when they're on the stand as to the deal they've cut. That's always made clear to the jury. And they bring all the baggage with them, and it's always laid out there for the jurors to determine. And if there's enough additional evidence, corroborating evidence, then they can be effective witnesses. In and of themselves, there's enough to attack that you can undermine their credibility.
What have government witnesses been able to expose about how organized crime families work, whether it's the Scarfo family, crime family, or John Gotti?
Well, I think what's happened in the last 7 or 8 years, I mean, I think there's been more mobsters who have flipped in the last 7 or 8 years than any time in history. And I think what they've shown is a view from the inside looking out of organized crime that we've never had before, the government's never had before. And what they've also done is created such paranoia within the organizations that the mob itself is less effective now. I mean, everybody's worried about who's wearing a wire, whether this phone is tapped, whether there's a bug in this room. And that paranoia makes the institution of the mafia less effective. So it feeds off itself.
Would you say they've also tarnished the romantic image of the mafia?
Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing. And whether or not there ever were men of honor, I mean, there's a real debate about that. And I don't want to glamorize the mob. And I don't think Mario Puzo's mob ever really existed except in his book and on the screen. But there was a time, I think, when at least some of these individuals embraced that whole code of, you know, long before Spike Lee, the phrase do the right thing existed among mobsters. And there's a whole code of conduct, you know, do the right thing. The right thing meant, you know, you didn't rat on your friends. And if you were pinched or arrested and you got convicted, you just did the time. And your family would be taken care of. And when you came out, there would be a place in the organization again. That at least is the way it seemed to operate until, I guess, the last maybe 10 years. And all of that has changed now.
Well, you really call, and this was a piece in the Philadelphia Inquirer, you call Phil Leonetti a symbol of the demise of the American mafia.
Right.
What does he symbolize?
I think Leonetti and Sammy the Bull, Salvatore Gravano in New York, and Michael Franzese, another New York mobster who flipped. Basically, the difference, and this was explained to me by a couple law enforcement people, for the old timers and to a large degree for mafia figures in Sicily, the mafia is a way of life. For guys like Leonetti and Gravano and Franzese, the mafia was a way to make money. Now, when they got in trouble with the law and they're facing a long prison term, since the mafia is a way to make money and it's a business, you make a business decision. Well, you're going to walk away from that and cut your best deal. And that's what they've done. And I think that, in essence, and it's kind of simplistic, is the basis of what's going on.
Well, of course, people like Leonetti are American-born. Do you think literally being born in this country and not in Sicily creates a different relationship with organized crime?
That's part of it. And also being growing up in basically middle-class America rather than in a ghetto where everything was a struggle. I mean, I think the second and third generation of the American mafia are very much Americanized, very much suburbanized, and they've embraced the American dream. You know, a nice car, a nice house, nice clothes. All of those things mattered more than the institution of and this thing of ours. This thing of ours was more important than this thing of mine, and this thing of mine was my lifestyle. And that's what's being taken away from me. How do I get it back? Well, if I got to rat out a couple of my friends, I'll do it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about comparing the lifestyles. We'll say let's take a first generation organized crime.
Well, take Angelo Bruno, let's for example, here in Philadelphia, okay. Or Carlo Gambino in New York,
okay.
As opposed to John Gotti or Nicky Scarfo. Angelo Bruno lived in a row house in South Philadelphia. He wore suits off the rack. He drove an old car. And basically operated in the shadows. I think Bruno recognized that there was a time to push and a time to pull back, and that you couldn't always have everything you wanted exactly when you wanted it. In a lot of ways, I mean, you know, it's almost like talking about what's happening in society in general and with kids today. You can't have everything the minute you want it. And Bruno recognized that. And I think the other thing, and Gambino as well, Bruno and Gambino recognized that they were heads of an institution, and their goal was to ensure the continuation of that institution, their crime family.
So they had a sense of the past and a sense of the future.
Right, where it was going, and they were kind of preserving an institution. I think what happened with Scarfo in Philadelphia and Gotti in New York, they came to believe that they were the institution, that they could do whatever they wanted. And they became very ruthless and cutthroat. And that played into the fears of the people who worked for them. And when things got tough for fellows like Caramondi and Del Giorno, and they had crossed Scarfo, they thought they were going to be killed, they turned to the government as witnesses. Down the road, Gravano and Leonetti, who saw everybody going down the tubes, decided they didn't want to follow suit, and they became cooperating witnesses.
George Anastasia is my guest today on Fresh Air, and he's a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. He specializes, his beat is organized crime and white-collar crime. Also, the author of a book which came out last year called Blood and Honor. We're talking about organized crime and the changing face of organized crime. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking today with journalist George Anastasia about organized crime. Well, let's talk a little bit about the lifestyle of John Gotti and the lifestyle of Nicky Scarfo. Of course, both of these people found guilty. How did they live?
Gotti lived, you know, Gotti was, I guess, the quintessential New York celebrity. He was a gangster, but he was a guy who had mastered the soundbite. He could give you a 30-second quip coming out of court that would be leading the TV news that night. You know, he wore expensive suits. He dined at the best restaurant. I mean, it's that kind of lifestyle that, you know, it's almost in your face. I'm who I am. I do what I want. Scarfo was like that in Atlantic City, you know, ringside at the fights. He had a palatial home in Fort Lauderdale. He had a yacht. He loved the movie Casablanca. He christened his boat The Usual Suspects. They would go out. The whole crew of the mob would go out on fishing trips, FBI would be surveilling them, and there would go to Usual Suspects. They were thumbing their nose at these guys.
Well, but what made them think they could get away with it?
We're being pop psychologists, but another part of it was almost the arrogance of the 80s. I think these guys were the dark side of Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky, in that the 80s were a time of, you know, greed is good, get it all, get it now, take no prisoners.
These were yuppie mobsters?
Yeah, I mean, it was they embraced the philosophy of the times. And what was happening on Wall Street, these guys were doing in the underworld, you know, grabbing it with both fists. And they thought they were immune to prosecution and they could do whatever they wanted to do.
Well, who then do you think is filling the void and looking at things like gambling and racketeering and loan sharking and prostitution and the businesses that seem to go along with organized crime? Who are the operators?
I mean, they're always – that's like – it's like a market demand. There's a demand for that product. Somebody will always deliver it. I think certainly I'm not here to say that the mob's been wiped out and they're out of business. I think they've been dealt a serious blow, and in a lot of ways they're reorganizing. In Philadelphia, they're certainly reorganizing. I think one thing that's come more to light in the last 4 or 5 years is that there has always been an active Sicilian mafia operating in America, and that's been involved primarily in heroin and drugs and narcotics, but that's certainly an organization that could fill the leadership vacuum that's starting to exist in the American mafia.
Now, by saying Sicilian mafia, you're talking about the mafia that has then real connections to Sicily, not just emotional connections, but
Yeah, right. I'm talking about made members of Sicilian mob families who are living and working in the United States, but are not necessarily connected to the American La Casa Nostra.
What families are we talking about?
One prime example, I guess, is here in Philadelphia, where according to most law enforcement people, the fellow who's trying to put the family back together in the wake of the murders and prosecutions is Sicilian-born John Stanfa. And most law enforcement people tell me now that Stanfa is the guy in charge.
What can you tell us about John Stanfa?
Stanfa was born in Sicily, came to this country in the late 1960s or 70s, was always perceived as kind of a hanger-on. He was around Angelo Bruno, drove the car the night Bruno was killed, may have been involved in the Bruno assassination plot, was convicted of perjury in 1981 and did the right thing. He went away, didn't say anything about anybody, and spent nearly 6 years in jail. Comes out of jail, supposedly he's supposed to go back to Sicily. But according to, again, to the informants who are now cooperating, a deal was cut between John Gotti and Nicky Scarfo, allowing Stanfa first to stay in this country. And after Scarfo went away to jail, Stanfa came back to Philadelphia, and by 1990-91 is emerging as the new boss. The implication is from law enforcement is he's clearly got connections with the New York families, and the New York families probably have the best connections to the Sicilian mob. So it's like a web.
What's it like as a reporter to cover organized crime and white collar crime as well? And have you ever had threats on your life?
I had one threat from a fellow after I wrote the book. More recently, I had the mother of a fellow I wrote about who was very upset with me, who said she would like to throw me or have somebody throw me out the window. But that was more emotional than anything. I have always been fascinated with this particular topic. And I think part of it is because of my background. I mean, my grandparents came from Sicily. My mother and father grew up in South Philadelphia. My father is the same age as a lot of these people. And you look at my father and what he became and what they became and coming off the same streets, and you say, well, people always have to make choices as they go along. I mean, that's one of the things he taught me. You know, you make choices and you live with them.
Well, even as a journalist, do you see yourself as defending your roots, your heritage, to say that not all Sicilians are connected to the mafia?
I mean, I get into that. I mean, I even get into that in discussions over the kitchen table with other members of my family. I have a different, I guess, a different outlook on this than some other people. There are some people who believe in stereotypes, you know, that all blacks are this, or if your name ends in a vowel and you've got money, you must be a gangster. And there are some people in my family and elsewhere who think every time you write about the mafia, you're reinforcing that stereotype. Well, my position is, and maybe I'm naive, is the person with the stereotype has the problem, not me. I mean, I know the contribution Italian Americans have made to this country and to the world in terms of culture and science and any field you want to look at. So somebody who wants to believe in a stereotype, it's their problem, not mine.
Well, let me ask you, if indeed organized crime is changing, and as you describe it, it looks, at least you believe that it is, and if organized crime becomes more private, more like the old days, how will that change your job as a journalist? When people aren't being brutally murdered on the street corners and people aren't turning state's evidence and all that, how will that change your job as a journalist?
It becomes much more difficult, and in a lot of ways, it becomes an economic story. I mean, the trick really is to find out where these guys are and how they're making their money. And if they're going into the shadows, it's going to be more and more difficult to find that. You know, where's the money coming from to sustain the institutions? What legitimate businesses are they getting involved in? This trial in Philadelphia going on right now involves, as I said, the extortion of Willard Rouse for the Penn's Landing development. And, I mean, that's an example of how Scarfo did things as opposed to how Bruno would have done things. Scarfo sent somebody in to Rouse and said, we want $1 million or we're going to jam up this legislation in city council and you won't get your project. My belief is Bruno would have sent somebody twice removed to see one of Rouse's contractors and said, if you don't want to have any labor problems here, we can help you out, but so-and-so wants to have the vending machines and this other guy wants to have a subcontracting job here and there. And Bruno would have got his $1 million over the course of 5 years. Nobody would have been the wiser. Nobody would have gone to jail, and life would have gone on as usual. That's the difference. And if they're going to go back to that way of operating, it becomes more and more different for law enforcement, more and more difficult, and more and more difficult for me as a journalist to find out what they're about.
And what are you working on next?
I'm working on another book that I think will be interesting. It's kind of a different look at all of this, kind of the view of organized crime from across the kitchen table of a South Philadelphia row home. I'm talking to the ex-wife and the son of one of these mob figures, and they're telling me basically their story and what life was like growing up in that situation.
George Anastasia covers white-collar and organized crime for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's also the author of the book Blood and Honor about Nicholas Caramondi. This is Fresh Air.